Apparently, we wish to hear the introduction, so I'm having to speak from up here. I'm John Larkin. I'm not going to make a big spiel about Professor Phil Wilson's career. He tells me that he was educated in Oxford, which I think we have to believe because nobody would actually claim to have gone to Balliol. He then moved the normal step of progression from Oxford to become a GP in Glasgow, as he describes, about 50 yards away from the Victorian Infirmary, which he did for 23 years, before moving north to the Highlands, where a brief sojourn for maybe a couple of weeks doing locums made him a perfect candidate to be Professor of Primary Care and Rural Medicine.
Something like that, yeah.
In Aberdeen University. So without further ado, very much looking forward to hearing his talk on how early childhood experience determines our health.
Thanks very much, John, and thanks for coming. I'm going to talk about early childhood experience and the extent to which it does or does not determine our later health in life. I'm going to talk a bit about childhood deprivation and health. I'm going to talk about the impact of adverse childhood experiences, and in passing we'll mention the Glasgow effect, which I'm sure that some of you are pretty sick of hearing about, but I'll maybe give a slightly different spin on it. I'm going to talk about some of the mechanisms which link early childhood experience with later health, bits about the concept of critical and sensitive periods, a bit about the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis and the extent to which it's programmed early in life. I'm going to talk a little bit about parenting, about social learning and attachment, but only very briefly. I'm then going to talk a bit about how we can identify children whose trajectory is perhaps not going to be so good in order that we might conceivably intervene early. And I'm going to show some maps of social and emotional development in Glasgow. And then I'm going to talk finally a bit about some of the work that we're planning on doing in the future. I'm going to just mention this report, the Marmot report, which some of you will know about. I'm going to draw on it a little bit in this talk, but only a little bit. For those of you who are interested in a very well argued case that early childhood is crucial for our later health and that inequalities in childhood are the key to inequalities in health, you don't really need to go much further than the Marmot review. This is one of the figures from the Marmot review. If you remember, I'm going to start off and talk a bit about deprivation and health. So this is life expectancy. Let's just see if I can make this thing work. So we've got life expectancy up here on the y-axis, and on the x-axis we've got neighbourhood deprivation, and this is England, and the dots are local areas, and the least deprived areas, you will see a female has a life expectancy, this is male and female life expectancy on the top line, and you'll see that in the wealthiest areas the average person will live into their 80s, and in the poorest areas they'll live to about 70, 73 or 74. Okay, so that's life expectancy, and this is healthy life expectancy, and you'll see that the two curves, which are just the best fit line, the two curves roughly mirror each other, but in fact there's a slightly steeper gradient here, and we know this from the recent work you may have seen in The Lancet, that essentially multimorbidity in particular starts earlier the more deprived you are, and there's a slightly steeper social gradient in relation to the onset of morbidity. So healthy life expectancy is substantially lower in the poorer areas than in the richer areas. There's been a lot of work, and I'm not going to spend very much time on this, but there's been a lot of work which has looked at the mechanisms by which early childhood deprivation leads to later ill health. And this is one example of a very interesting paper in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, which looks at the programming of the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis and the systems, the cytokine systems of inflammatory signaling. And essentially what this paper showed is that regardless of current economic status, that in people who had who lived in poverty in early childhood had higher levels of cortisol, had lower levels of the mechanisms associated with glucocorticoid receptors, and had higher levels of the proteins involved in inflammatory signaling. And that's one example of many papers. There are lots of other pieces of biological research around deprivation. For example, we know that people living in born in deprived areas have shorter telomeres on their chromosomes than people living in wealthier areas. This is a slide that I've borrowed with permission from Harry Burns. Some of you will have seen it before if you've heard Harry speak. It's got Portugal on it, as you see. And this is life expectancy. Life expectancy on the y-axis here since 1850 up to the present day. And you'll see, as you would expect and hope, there's been a substantial increase and drawing together within Europe of life expectancy. So there's quite a wide variation here and quite a narrow range here. And you'll see the dips are associated with the world wars and other major civil catastrophes. What you can see here, the blue line is Scotland, and you can see that by and large, from about 1850, Scotland was bumping along in the middle of the league within Europe of life expectancy. And something happened round about the 1950s-ish, and it slipped to the bottom. So Scottish life expectancy is now just about the worst in Western Europe. And Portugal is notable because it's moved from a position of being very much the worst to being now above Scotland's life expectancy. So what happened? And that's what interests me. This is not actually about poverty or wealth. There's something else going on here in Scotland that accounts for a reduced life expectancy compared to its peer countries. Going back to this picture from the Marmot report, while it's true, undoubtedly, that on average there is a substantial effect of deprivation on life expectancy, there's also an enormous amount of variation within individual levels of deprivation. So, for example, I don't know what any of these areas actually are, but you can see that this area here is doing better than this area here in terms of life, of healthy life expectancy. So this deprivation is part of the story, but deprivation is not the whole story. And in fact, one of Phil Hanlon's recent papers suggests that the amount of life expectancy variation that you can explain by deprivation has actually dropped in recent years from about 60-odd% to just above 40%. So you can explain about 40% of the variation in mortality by area deprivation now. So that leaves 60% down to something else. And some of that is, of course, just pure chance, but some of it is some other factors that I'm going to be talking a little bit about just now. Now, within Glasgow, there's something else going on which perhaps might give us some useful clues as to what this other unexplained element is all about. Because if you compare health outcomes in Glasgow with health outcomes in Liverpool and Manchester, which have almost identical deprivation profiles, that's not often said, actually, but in fact, if you look at local area deprivation, the proportion of the population that are deprived, Glasgow, Manchester, Liverpool are pretty much on a par. Premature deaths in Glasgow are 30% higher, and that excess mortality is found in both men and women. It's found at all ages, apart from the very young. And it's found both in deprived areas and non-deprived areas, as Richard said before while we were having dinner, that even doctors in Manchester can expect to live 3 years longer than doctors in Glasgow. What explains this? This is another slide that I've borrowed with permission from Harry. This is standardised mortality ratios comparing Glasgow with Liverpool and Manchester. Okay, so this is the 100. So this is if Glasgow is equal to the other cities, you'd expect all these blocks to be on that line there. And this is looking at what it is that people die of that explains the difference between Glasgow, Liverpool and Manchester. We've got a 12% excess risk of cancer, of dying of cancer in Glasgow. We've got a, in terms of standardised mortality ratios, this is corrected for age. Circulatory system, again, about 12% increase. Lung cancer in particular, 26.7%. Well, there's more of a behavioural component to lung cancer, obviously, than some of the other things, or more of an obvious behavioural component to it. External causes, this is accidents and violence and so on, 30% increase. Suicide, 68% increase. Alcohol-related illness, more than twofold increase. And drugs-related and poisoning, 2.5 times Manchester and Liverpool. Now, obviously, cancers and circulatory system deaths are more common than deaths from these other causes. But in fact, more than half of the difference in mortality between Glasgow and Manchester and Liverpool is caused by these factors here. Smoking, alcohol, drugs, violence. Okay. I'm going to take a bit of a step here. I'm going to come back later to factors that link, make this step make a bit more sense. I'm going to talk a bit about child well-being now, and because this is going to be the focus of my talk, it's going to be about why I think that Glasgow is doing so badly compared with everywhere else. The UNICEF domains of child well-being are very well piloted and used now. They've been used, I think, for about 20 or 30 years for measuring the well-being of children in different countries and comparing the well-being of children in different countries. And there are six domains: material deprivation, health and safety, educational well-being, relationships, behaviours and risks, and self-assessed indicators of well-being, so subjective well-being. Okay, so there are six indicators, and they all have particular items associated with them. I haven't got time to go through the individual questions, but essentially it's a relatively simple scoring system that you can use. You take a sample of a few thousand children, and you collect the data for these children, and you can get a score. Guess where Scotland is? Scotland actually isn't on this figure because it's way down here. But this is the list of European countries plus the United States, just added in for comparison purposes. These are the countries at the top. Netherlands, usual suspects. Netherlands, Sweden, Denmark, Finland, Spain, perhaps a bit of a surprise. Switzerland and Norway. You kind of expect them to be at the top of places where it's good to be a child, I guess. At the bottom, Czech Republic, France, Portugal, Austria, Hungary. United States, in comparison, is doing rather badly. And the UK is definitely very much at the bottom of the Premier League. This is the Western European countries, largely. UK is doing very badly, and Scotland is down substantially below that. Okay, so that makes Scotland, if it was to be analysed as a separate country, it would make Scotland very much at the bottom of the European countries in terms of child well-being. And if we look at this, I'm using UK data here because actually Scotland's just like the UK but a bit worse. You can see that it's doing very badly on material deprivation, In comparison, this is the proportion of people living in poverty rather than the median or mean. It's doing rather well on health and safety. Isn't that sad, actually, that that's the only thing that we're any good at? Educational well-being, we're right down at near the bottom. Relationships, we're very, very much at the bottom. And behaviour and risk, very much at the bottom. Subjective well-being, pretty much at the bottom as well. So children are not happy here. Their relationships are not so good. There are a lot of problems with risk behaviour. A lot of exposure to violence, for example, if you're a child in Scotland, compared with most other countries in Europe. The relationships area is interesting. The questions within the relationships ones are about how much time you spend with your parents. Do you share a meal with them every day? And Scotland and the UK are right at the bottom for those sort of indices. So could this be where the root of the ill health of Scotland is? Could it be the root of where the ill health in Glasgow is? Ooh, UK at the bottom, sorry. Right, another leap. This is, you'll see Richard Watson's name here. This is why I got interested in all this stuff in the first place. it's nice to see Lynn here as well, who was also part of this adventure. Those of you who are old enough will remember that in the early 1990s, we had the main cause of death among young people in Glasgow was injecting drug use. And some of you may also remember that our psychiatric colleagues decided that it wasn't their problem. And we set up some methadone clinics in general practice, which we wrote about in the British Medical Journal. One of the things that Richard and I and Lynn and other people who were involved in these methadone clinics did was spend quite a lot of time with our patients. Initially, we were seeing them pretty much every week, I seem to remember, when we first started running our methadone clinics. And three things really struck me. One is that every one of the patients that we were dealing with in our methadone clinics had experienced a lot of pretty terrible things in their childhood. That was the first thing, it's very striking. This just a lot of catastrophes, a lot of death, a lot of violence, sexual abuse. Second thing that struck me was if you talked to them about their childhoods, a lot of them would say how miserable they were at school and how they couldn't understand the teacher, how they couldn't concentrate, how bad their behaviour was, that they didn't understand the rules about relationships with their children, which led me to think that quite a lot of these people actually had identifiable problems as children, behavioural type problems or psychiatric diagnoses even in some cases. The third thing that was really striking, we had a researcher who worked with George Ralston at the Southern General Hospital who came into our practice. And she did anonymized interviews with our patients. And one of the themes that came out of those interviews was, when we started off this business, we kind of were making it up a bit as we were going along. And we did supervised urine samples on our patients on a fairly regular basis because we wanted to know really what was going on. We wanted to know how much illicit drug use people had and so on. And one of the things that, a couple of our patients said to the researcher was that they knew that how much we hated doing this supervised urine sampling stuff, but nobody had ever cared about them as much as that. So they were actually saying something quite positive about the fact that a doctor or a nurse was watching them pass urine, which is quite a revealing thing, I think, in terms of the attachment status of the patient. Okay, moving on a bit. Adverse childhood experiences. Have any of you come across the ACEs study, the Vincent Felitti, United States, Kaiser Permanente organisation in the United States? It's a big primary care organisation. Felitti ran an obesity clinic, and he was very struck by a few quite interesting things about people who dropped out of treatment, and there was a strong association between dropping out of treatment and his accounts of people giving him adverse childhood experiences. And he developed a little questionnaire which looked at abuse, emotional, physical, sexual abuse, household dysfunction in childhood, whether there was violence in the household, alcoholic drug using, family member, member who was had a criminal record, etc., and histories of physical and emotional neglect. Okay, so it's a simple questionnaire. It takes about 5 minutes to complete, and you get a score. And you get a score in each of these domains. You either score one or none for each domain. So you've only got a score on one of the ten. Measures here to get a point in that domain. And what Felice and Ander found in this study was they asked people with problems with injecting drug use. Remember, this is a middle class population in the United States in an HMO. And proportion who've injected drugs from 0 to 3.5 on the y-axis. This is the number of adverse childhood experiences, and you can see this confirmed the impression that we got in our methadone clinic, that if you haven't had any adverse childhood experiences, then your chance of being an injecting drug user are about 0.2%. And if you've had four or more on that simple questionnaire, then your chance of being an injecting drug user are about 3.5%. Okay, so quite a substantial relationship there between adverse childhood experience and injecting drug use. Similar, Hillis did this work using the same questionnaire, risks of being an alcoholic, again from 1% of people with no adverse childhood experiences up to about 7% with people scoring 4+. Okay? It's not just about substance use. This obviously is more closely related to substance use. This is liver disease. Again, you see a gradient so that if you've had more than four adverse childhood experiences, you're more than twice as likely to have liver disease. Similarly with COPD, roughly doubles your risk. If you look at heart disease and correct it for lipid levels, smoking, diabetes risk, you get another effect of childhood adverse childhood experiences, so that a single point on the adverse childhood experience questionnaire will increase your risk of heart disease by 1.7 times for emotional abuse, 1.5 times physical abuse, etc. Okay. Moving on again, I'm now going to move on to an area where I'm going to try and make some links between adverse childhood experience and later health. I think I've demonstrated that there is a risk of physical health which is greatly increased by adverse childhood experience. These two slides I showed in my last speech here 5 years ago. So if any of you were attentive at that time, you may remember them. This looks at the relationship between harsh parenting and conduct disorder. There's a strong association between having been physically abused as a child and conduct disorder. Conduct disorder is aggressive, violent, antisocial behaviour well beyond the normal range. We know that the earlier the exposure to abuse, the greater the risk. We know that conduct disorder is more common in boys. And we know that in terms of the experience of physical abuse, that some individuals are more prone to developing conduct problems than others. It may be that the ones that don't develop conduct problems are more likely to develop depression. But there are great variations in the response to adverse parenting in this way. This is a figure from one of the best of many fabulous papers from the Dunedin cohort. I'm a massive fan of the Dunedin cohort because it's pretty much the only birth cohort or near birth cohort that has managed to keep everybody in, or all the people I'm interested in anyway. Most cohorts lose people who have problems with the law, who've got problems with drug abuse, who have psychiatric disorder, whereas the Dunedin cohort keeps them all in. It keeps them all in because it flies them back to New Zealand every year, and it visits them in prison in Australia, and it actually spends quite a lot of money keeping hold of all the people that were brought into the cohort. So they've, at the age of 40-odd, they've still got 96% of the people who were in the cohort when they were aged three. So they've kept everybody in. What they showed here, and this is looking at monoamine oxidase type A gene, which is on the X chromosome. Lower levels of activity in animal studies have been shown to be associated with aggression. It's perhaps no accident that it lies on the X chromosome, because if you're female, you're twice as likely to have the active form of the monoamine oxidase type A gene. Okay, so there are two forms. There's a short form, which is relatively inactive, and there's a long form, which is relatively active. And in fact, this is quite a common polymorphism, because about a third of the population have the relatively inactive form of monoamine oxidase type A. If you look at people with low levels of monoamine oxidase activity, and what you see is in individuals who have not experienced abuse as children, their risk of conduct problems, this is in a small group of boys, this is about 20%. If you've got low monoamine oxidase type A activity and you have been abused, you've got a risk of nearly 80% of having conduct disorder. If you're lucky enough to have high monoamine oxidase type A activity, then it seems that there is a protective effect, because even if you've experienced abuse and you've got the active form of monoamine oxidase type A, then your risk doesn't rise very much if you've been abused. Okay? So this is one of the first published examples in humans of a gene-environment interaction. There is a gene which protects you against the effect of harsh parenting. And that obviously will explain some of the variability between people's propensity to violence when they've experienced adversity in childhood. It doesn't mean that the gene, if you have got the inactive form, actually makes you violent. It just means that if people are violent towards you, you're more likely to be violent towards others. Okay, so that's adverse childhood experience, and what I'm particularly interested in is the relationship between psychopathology in childhood and later health. As I explained, the Dunedin study is a bit of a jewel in the birth cohort studies, because it's managed to keep people in. We always get selective attrition of people with problems. There's another problem about longitudinal studies, it's a bit of a hobby horse of mine. Actually, there's not very much funding for this sort of stuff, because this is drug companies are not interested in it very much, and setting up birth cohorts is very expensive. What we have got, though, from the cohort studies is we've got a lot of evidence of a longitudinal increased risk for people with ADHD of developing substance use problems. There's if you use the American DSM-IV diagnostic criteria, then you've got about a 5% risk of having ADHD or conduct problems as a child. And according to who you read, that will roughly between double and quadruple your chance of having problem substance use as an adult. We know from Dunedin in particular that there are very strong associations between conduct disorder and later psychopathology of all different kinds. It's not just antisocial personality disorder, which is the obvious sort of straight line progression of antisocial people. But there are also relations between, for example, conduct disorder and schizophrenia later in life. We also know that conduct disorder is associated with substantial mortality. You've got about a ninefold greater chance of dying before the age of 40 if you've got conduct disorder than if you haven't got it. Okay, dossing about a bit here, but I want to talk a bit now about what the possible mechanisms might be by which these bad things happening to us and also happening to our mothers, I'll talk about that in a minute, can affect our later health outcomes. Most of you will know this, but some of you will have forgotten it. During early brain development, we're born with a brain which is about a quarter of our adult size brain. By the time we've reached the age of four, our brain's about 95% of its adult size. There's a huge physical growth of brain in the first 4 years of life. The number of neurons is pretty much set down at 6 months of gestation, so it's not that we're getting more neurons in our brain, it's just that there are increasing numbers of glial cells and increasing connectivity of the neurons. And the processes which are happening in the first 4 years from the neurological point of view are really about synaptogenesis and myelination of neurons. This is one of my favourite pictures of a Golgi stained sections of prefrontal cortex. You can see up the number of cell bodies is pretty much the same across the three slides, very much comparable areas of the brain. And you can see that at birth, we've got very simple single axons and a few dendrites, not much connected to each other. When you're six, you've got same number of cell bodies, you've got a massive tangle of interconnections of dendrites, lots and lots of synapses. And by the time you're 14, same number of cell bodies again, but much far fewer connections. So what's happening here is this is the process of synaptic pruning. This is the, if you don't use it, you lose it phenomenon. So neural pathways which are established and are used for traffic, so to speak, remain, and areas, circuits which are not used wither away. The visual system is used as a sort of classic example of a critical period. We know that if you've got a dense cataract at the age of when you're born, then you will effectively lose the use of that eye by the time you're about a year old if you don't do something about it. In the case of hypermetropia, you have got a bit longer before you lose the use of the eye. But essentially what happens is that at the lateral geniculate nucleus level, you get selective pruning of signals from the eye which isn't working properly. You can prevent that loss of connectivity in the case of hypermetropia by patching the good eye and forcing traffic to come from the bad eye. Okay? If you patch before the age of four, you get a very good result, and you can get normal 6/6 vision in the hypermetropic eye. If you don't start patching until after a child's four, then you get not quite such a good effect, and you have to do a lot more patching. By the time the child's about seven or eight, you're wasting your time. So by that stage, you have lost the capacity to form useful connections at the lateral geniculate nucleus level. That's the classic example of a critical period. If you haven't got useful connections, useful signals coming from an eye by the time you're seven, and you haven't done something about it, you will lose the connectivity and you can't get it back again. And one of the big questions in my area of research is the question of whether other areas, cognitive development, social development, emotional development, actually follow the same pattern. Do we have critical periods? This is a summary of the sensitivity. This is really based on expert opinion rather than on a set of detailed randomized controlled trials. But this is sensitivity to stimulus. And this is age. And this is looking at a number of different types of higher mental function and the sensitivity that we have to input. So take, for example, language. We know that children learn language much better when they're younger than when they're older, and you can actually pretty much map the rate at which children are capable of learning language. So this is the visual system and the auditory system. They both follow this critical period kind of model, habitual ways of responding to stimuli. Emotional control, very similar to that. Language has got a much slower fall off of the critical period, or the sensitive period rather. So what we can see here is that for most of these functions, you get the biggest bang for your buck really in the preschool years in terms of input, and you have to apply more stimulus to get effective learning or use of these functions later in life. And some colleagues and I did a systematic review looking for one of the mechanisms of a possible critical period development. We were interested in the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, which, as I mentioned earlier, is one of the candidates for programming of social and emotional development. We know, for example, in depression in adulthood, that there are, in many cases, distinct abnormalities of the HPA axis. And those of you done dexamethasone suppression tests will remember that. We looked at the literature on whether early exposure to adversity alters the stress response of the adrenal cortex. This is a very complicated slide, and I'm not going to go through it in any detail. You'll probably be relieved to hear. But essentially what we found is that of the 30-odd studies that we looked at, about 27 of them showed that there was evidence of programming of the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis according to early adversity. And essentially the younger that a child was exposed to adversity, and the biggest effect being in utero, the bigger the propensity the child was to have an exaggerated stress response. But it all became a little bit complicated in later childhood, so that we got exaggerated stress responses in early life, and it seemed to be able to go in more than one different way later on. But almost all the studies showed that early adversity produces changes in the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis later in life. Again, I'm not going to dwell on this, but this is just a reminder, again, for those of you that don't remember this stuff from medical school or whenever it was you did know it. The maternal hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis is nice and straightforward. The corticotrophin-releasing hormone produced by hypothalamic neurons releases ACTH from the pituitary, which in turn stimulates the production of cortisol from the adrenal cortex, and there's a negative feedback loop. And similarly, in the fetus, you get the hypothalamus releases CRH, which releases ACTH from the pituitary, which in turn releases cortisol from the fetal adrenal. But there is something else going on in pregnancy, and that's the placenta produces its own form of corticotrophin-releasing hormone, placental CRH, and that has a positive feedback effect in relation to cortisol. So the more cortisol is circulating in maternal blood, the more placental CRH is released, and that affects both the mother's pituitary and the baby's pituitary. So you get this positive feedback loop. So essentially, if you can imagine, the more stressed the mother is, the higher the level of circulating cortisol, that creates more, or leads to the production of more placental CRH, and that in turn causes more cortisol release both in the fetus and in the mother. And so you actually get an exaggerated stress response. You get more cortisol produced in pregnancy in response to stress than you do at other times. And that can have a very substantial effect on the fetus. Cortisol doesn't necessarily get from the maternal circulation into the fetal circulation because it's blocked by the 11-beta-hydroxysteroid dehydrogenase, which is another control mechanism which I probably haven't really got time to talk about. The Romanian orphan studies are one of the sort of landmark set of studies which looked at abnormalities of hypothalamic pituitary adrenal function. institutionalised remaining orphans, if you'll remember, there were a very large number who were put at birth into orphanages, and where they were neglected. And many of these children were fostered or adopted later in life. What you find in these children is that they have mild cognitive impairment. They're about 10 IQ points down on the average. They have a lot of impulsive behaviour. They have attention deficits in social relationships. They tend to be indiscriminately friendly. And they've got abnormalities of HPA function. This is a figure looking at levels of, remember the cortisol diurnal rhythm, it's high in the morning and it goes down later on in the day. These are evening cortisol levels, and the longer a child spends in institutional care, the higher their evening cortisol becomes. They tend to lose their circadian rhythm of cortisol. And this can have a very toxic effect on the developing child's brain. This is a slide that I also showed 5 years ago. It's quite a chilling slide, really. These are PET scans which indicate metabolic activity of various brain regions. What they did was essentially took 10 Romanian orphan children, and they took rather more than that group of controls, can't remember how many it was now, 10 orphans and 24 controls. They added up all the orphan scans and they added up all the control scans, and they subtracted one from the other, and the black areas are the areas of metabolic hypoactivity in the orphans. Okay, got it? And you can see that these areas of significantly reduced metabolic activity, the supraorbital frontal cortex, the infralimbic prefrontal cortex, the temporal lobe, both the medial temporal structures, the hippocampus and amygdala, and the lateral temporal structures and bits of the brain stem are all hypoactive. All those bits of brain are part of the mechanism which control the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. And if you measure, and there have been a few studies done by Michael Meany's group where they've looked at suicide brains, what they've found is that these areas have all got, in children who've experienced abuse or neglect, have got very, very low levels of glucocorticoid receptors, which kind of explains the lack of effective feedback of the HPA axis. Neglected children. I haven't got much time to talk about the epigenetics, but it's an interesting area. The mechanism by which this happens is now quite well understood in animal models. Some of you may have come across the mouse licking story, you know, about Michael Meany's mice. No. If you're a baby mouse and you get licked by your mother a lot, then you are much more affectionate to your children later in life. You're much more likely not to exhibit indiscriminately sexual behaviour, and you're much less likely to be aggressive. And what's particularly interesting about this is it's transmitted from generation to generation. If you are a mouse that's licked by your mother, you're more likely to be a mother, if you're female, who licks your own mice, baby mice. And the mechanism by which this happens is to do with inactivation of the glucocorticoid receptor genes. It's actually been, as I say, been very well characterised now. We know exactly which genes it is that are affected. The mechanism is that the histones, which are coiled, which the DNA is coiled around, if your DNA is tightly coiled around a histone, then that gene is effectively inactivated. And you that happens as a result of changes taking place in the histone proteins to do with methylation and acetylation. If your mother licks you a lot, then your histones in the which the glucocorticoid receptor is wrapped around are much less likely to be methylated than if your mother doesn't lick you. So it's actually now quite well characterised what it is, in mice anyway, that links maternal affection with later behaviour. Okay, I'm going to move completely away from this mechanistic stuff now, just to a little bit of work that my colleagues and I have been involved in Glasgow, 5 or 10 minutes, and then we'll be finished. Using other people's data, we've been trying to find, are there early signs, are there early risk factors for later conduct problems? And looking at the Growing Up in Scotland cohort data was one of those pieces of work. We looked at 2,000 children's data who had strengths and difficulties questionnaire. That's a questionnaire that we've been used. I'll talk about that in just a minute. We compared children who had conduct problems with children who didn't have conduct problems as reported by their parents. This is published just recently. We had 90 children whose parents reported that they always had conduct problems, and 1,557 whose parents didn't have conduct problems. What we found was that the factors associated with having persistent conduct problems, having two parents in the household was strongly protective. Having good health was strongly protective. When the child being able to express himself or herself was strongly protective. Maternal smoking during pregnancy was associated with an increased risk of conduct problems. Parents who think that smacking is a good idea are more likely to have children with conduct problems. Likelihood that the child being taken to see other children seems to be a protective factor, and whether the child is read to almost made statistical significance, but not quite. So those are the sort of factors, maybe those are the sort of equivalent of the mouse licking, which can protect against aggressive behaviour in children. We've looked at another cohort, the Avon Longitudinal Study of Parents and Children, and we've had a series of publications from this cohort. We've been given 1,000 videos of one-year-olds and their mothers, and the children whose videos we've got all had a psychiatric assessment at age 7. So we looked at these videos of mothers reading a book to their children, and we looked at all kinds of different behaviours. This is very nerdy stuff. We looked at the videos and we tried to find whether there was anything that would distinguish the children who did go on to get a psychiatric diagnosis from those who didn't. 60 children had some sort of psychiatric diagnosis, and we compared them with 120 controls. We didn't know which were which. What we found so far is I put a team of psychiatrists, very clever eminent psychiatrists, and some very clever eminent psychologists in two separate teams, one team of psychologists, one team of psychiatrists, and asked them to guess which children had psychiatric disorder later on in life, and they performed no better than chance. Unfortunately for me, because I work with both teams of people, there was no difference. They were as bad as each other at it. So that was a bit of a relief. What we also found was that infant motor activity, this was one of our hypotheses, that more active infants that were restless would be more likely to have ADHD. Well, they didn't. That was a bit of a surprise. Now, hold on, this thing seems to have frozen. Oh no, here we are, that's it. This is what we did with our videos of, it's not playing. That's a pity. This is an example of how nerdy we really are. This is every various points in an infant's body, and we recorded it for every frame of every video. And we looked at the movement, and we added up the speed and acceleration and the periodicity and all kinds of things. Anyway, none of them were associated with psychopathology. Increased infant vocalization was associated with psychopathology, and that was the only thing that we saw in the children that was different. Children who were vocalising more were more likely to have disruptive behaviour disorders, ADHD and conduct disorder. But the most striking finding of all is that maternal hypoactivity was associated with ADHD and with conduct disorder. So mothers who are doing less are more likely to produce children with disruptive behaviour problems. And that wasn't just to do with physical activity, it was also to do with vocalisation. So the less the mother said, the more likely the child was to have conduct disorder or ADHD. And we counted positive parenting behaviours, smiling, praising the child, cuddling, all those sort of positive things. We counted them, just 1, 2, 3, 4. And we counted negative parenting behaviours. We didn't find an association between negative parenting behaviours and disorders, probably because they were quite rare. The families were on video and on their best behaviour. But we could count positive behaviours quite a lot. And there was a strong association of positive parenting behaviours with reduced risk of psychopathology later in life. Again, it's the mouse-licking stuff, I think. Similarly, reduced mutual gaze and shared attention in children who went on to get conduct disorder. Whether that's to do with the callous unemotional traits that people with conduct disorder go on to develop, I don't really know. Even when we adjusted for maternal depression, because we know there's an association between maternal depression and conduct disorder and ADHD, but even when we adjusted for that, there was no, there was still this link between inactive mothering and children who went on to get problems. So that's just that's that those papers are in press at the moment. Okay, coming to the very end now. Glasgow Parenting Support Framework. This is a group of colleagues and myself working on this in Glasgow. Some of you probably know that there's a lot of interest in parenting going on at the moment in Glasgow. We've been collecting data to try and work out whether it's doing any good or not. We're monitoring the interventions, but we're also measuring population level data, assessing social, emotional, behavioural problems at various different ages. And we're looking for changes in the population over time and what might influence those. The core of it is we're using a thing called the Strengths and Difficulties Questionnaire. It's a 25-item questionnaire. It takes about 5 minutes to complete. It comes in two versions, one that teachers can fill in, one that, well, three versions really, one that teachers can do, one that parents can do, one that young people can do when they're a little bit older, old enough to do it. And it comes in, there are two slightly different versions for young children and older children. It's been used a lot as a before and after tool. It's not a diagnostic instrument because it's only 25 questions, and there's only five questions on each of the five domains in it, which are emotional problems, conduct problems, hyperactivity and attention problems, peer relationship problems, and then there's a positive one, which is pro-social behaviour. If you add the first four items up, that gives you the total difficulty score, which is about 70% of children who are in what's called the abnormal range of the total difficulty score will have some psychiatric diagnosis. So it was used originally as a psychiatric screening tool, but it can also be used to measure change. So we are measuring this at 30 months. It's being rolled out across Glasgow starting in April, but we have got data from a fairly large sample of children at 30 months. This is parents reporting on their children's social and emotional development. It's been done by nursery staff in every school, in every nursery in Glasgow, which is either local authority nursery or what's called a partnership nursery. Starting this year, it's been done by teachers for primary three children, and at P6, every child in Glasgow is going to be completing one of these next year as well. And the idea is that we're going to link these and look and see which children are going up the way and down the way in the scores. 30-month results, we've got the first batch. It seems to be a very easy tool to use. We had a language question in as well as a strength and difficulties questionnaire. About 20% seem to have some problem on one or other of the subscales of the SDQ or had a language problem. There was a lot of overlap between language and other developmental problems. A lot of the children that had problems were considered by health visitors to be at low risk, which kind of shows that you can't necessarily, unless you actually ask about these problems, you can't predict whether they're likely to be there. We've got lots of data from preschool children, been running that for 3 years now. We've got about 10,500 children's data. We've been doing some modelling, looking at what the possible factors are associated with scores in preschool children. We found out that scores, as we know from the literature and from our own life experience, scores are higher in boys. They're about 1.4 times higher in boys. They're higher in looked after children, and they're also higher in areas of deprivation. And the plan is to actually measure trajectory, so we can use data linkage to connect these points, so we can collect the health visitor data and connect that into the preschool data, connect it into the school data. And we'll start, we're now in just about at the time when we're starting to do our very first data linkages and starting to link the trajectories from 30 months to 5 years. Very soon we'll be starting to link the 5 years with the 7 year data and so on. So we'll start to be able to look at some of the factors, for example, local area, school, provision of parenting support and so on, which might affect those trajectories later in life. And hopefully we'll have a good picture, if you invite me back in 5 years' time, if I'm still here, then we'll have a bit more, or a lot more information about what the local determinants of social and emotional development are in Glasgow. We might begin to get a little bit more idea of what underlies the differences in different areas within Glasgow, why it is that people in Carlton are so much more likely to die before they're 60 than people who live in Newton Mearns, for example. We'll be able to use data linkage to look at the determinants of these different trajectories. And I guess my big ambition would be to set up a new birth cohort in Glasgow. We've got a funding proposal in, but it's probably not going to happen. But that's what we're hoping to do ultimately. And these are all the people that I'd like to say thank you very much to. And actually, I didn't put Harry Burns on this, but he's provided me with four of the slides as well. So lots of people are part of all this scene. Thank you very much.
That's absolutely excellent. So, we do have time for one or two questions. Going to Duncan.
Well, there are certain sort of studies that stick in your mind, and the one that sticks in my mind was the one from New York about intervention. Are we not at the point where we know enough about the preschool age group and the association between that and later development to be focusing more on how you actually put the extra help in rather than looking for more information?
Yes, but I don't think we know enough about the right dose. For example, the New York studies, the Family Nurse Partnership, David Old's work, which I'm a huge fan, he did, for those of you who don't know, did some fabulous randomized controlled trials with 15-year follow-up where an intervention was delivered at random to some very vulnerable mothers, and with huge differences in outcomes in terms of conduct problems, problem drug use, violence, running away from home, etc., between the intervention and control groups. That's great, but he used it in New York, and he used it in a very special group of mothers, and the intervention was quite expensive. I would argue that it wouldn't be appropriate, because in fact what David Olds did was he came to the UK and he saw health visiting and thought, this is great, I'll take it back to the United States, turn it into a commodity and sell it back to the UK, which is actually what he did really. The thing is, it's a very intensive intervention, it's very expensive, it probably represents the very best that health visiting could be, in my view. The problem is it's not a proportionate thing, it's always a difficulty. You know, you've got a manualized intervention which is known to be efficacious, but in reality that can't be delivered to every family in the UK. I think what we do need to know is which families need what and when and how much of it. And again, I would argue that's what good health visiting should be, because the health visitor should have the capacity to judge how much a family needs and how much they don't. And I think it's very difficult to actually evaluate that properly. And I don't think, I mean, the evidence we had from our language study, for example, you know, 50% of children with language delay were not identified by health visitors as having any risk factors at all. So I think there, you know, you actually have to find good ways of identifying vulnerability. Some children and some families are going to need virtually nothing, and some children and some families are going to need an awful lot. And that, I think, is where the gap is in terms of information. But good quality schools, good quality nurseries will help everybody. The problem is that we can't afford to give everybody everything.
Maybe get another joint. What happened when it increases in the estimation to make Scotland go down? And are you think countries get better, or does Scotland...
Well, we all got better. I mean, everybody got better. It's just that we got better much slower than everybody else. I mean, Harry Burns would say this was all to do with the fact that our environment became less, what you would call salutogenic, became less health-giving. Family cohesion started to break down, I guess, is the obvious. factor. I mean, it's an unusual thing now for a child to expect to get a family meal every day. And I think that in the 1950s, that was very much the norm. I think that's a big social change. And certainly, you know, if you live in countries who do very much better on the UNICEF scales and actually have got better mortality rates than we've got now, like Cyprus, for example, which is not a rich country by any manner of means, their children spend a lot of time with their parents. So I would argue that time spent with your parents is the key thing. And I suspect if we were able to measure it well enough, we'd probably find that children in Scotland are spending substantially less time with their parents now than they were in the 1950s. And probably that decline is faster in Scotland than it is anywhere else. That's my hunch. It's about being licked by your mother, really.
Unfairly or maybe naturally on mothers. All your talk, I loved it and I thought it was great, and having come to Glasgow almost 12 years ago, I agree with, you know, everything you've said about deprivation, smoking, but all the rest of it. But when I've heard you talk, and even just then, about the lack of, you know, meal times with children, even as a working mother, you know, how do you do that in modern society and bring up your daughter and encourage her to have a career and all those things?
I think fathers are just as capable of licking their baby mice as mothers are. I mean, if what I've been saying has been gendered, it's because that's where the evidence has been. It's not because fathers can't be as good parents as mothers and provide as much nurturing. But I think the key issue is how does a child form a secure attachment to one or a very small number of adults? And that, I think, is the difficulty. And that's, I think, if we're going to improve our health, that's what we're going to have to find a way to be able to do. And when you look at countries like Norway, Sweden, Finland, the Netherlands, they've all got much better parental leave arrangements. You know, in Norway or Sweden, you've pretty much got to take a year off when your baby's born. And that time can be split between fathers and mothers. I think they're a long way ahead of us, really.
Is it possible that there is enough evidence to tease out the relative effects and the age of five of home parenting and good nursery schools? Because obviously there are two sides of that.
Yes is the answer, but there's going to be confounders, because parents who put their children into nursery care are going to be different to parents that don't, and you can't tell whether those factors are what's the key one. But we certainly can look at some of that. What you'd want to do in an ideal world would be to do a randomised controlled trial. And actually there was a very, very excellent randomised controlled trial in the United States called the High Scope Perry Project, which involved giving children in deprived areas either very, very good nursery provision or not at random. And the outcomes were massively better in the children that were put into high quality nursery provision.
And thank you very much again.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.